British Public Radio. Nature.
Coming up, a new time cloak could hide things by snipping holes in time.
We open up holes that are tens of picoseconds long, a very brief hole, but any event that occurs when that hole is not detected.
And it's 100 years since physicist Niels Bohr published his model of the atom. Today, physicists are pushing atoms to the extreme.
In a giant atom, electrons travel 100 billion nuclear diameters away. A giant atom like that is almost as big as a bacterium. It's as big as the full stop printed at the end of a sentence.
Plus, what's really happening to the Earth's ice sheets? I'm Thea Cunningham.
And I'm Kerry Smith. Fans of Harry Potter, or anyone who's just quite nosy at heart and wishes they could sneak around unnoticed, will have spent time thinking about invisibility cloaks. Well, they've been a scientific reality for a few years now, at least for hiding very small things. But no, you can't buy one yet. These cloaks hide things in space. But this week, a team from Purdue University in Indiana refine another type of cloak to conceal things not in space, but in time. It's an improvement over current time cloaks, which manage to hide one-off events that last a picosecond. That's a millionth of a millionth of a second. I spoke to the creator of the new time cloak, Andrew Weiner.
Maybe a simple analogy is suppose you're watching something, or scientifically we might be trying to record an event, and steering light either forward or backward in time so it avoids the event. That's what temporal cloaking is all about.
You're making kind of a hole in time.
That's right. The holes that we make, imagine a single beam of light, and actually in our case it will be a beam of light contained in an optical fiber, the same sort of cables that are used for high-speed telecom. And rather than having a continuous stream of light, we open up holes that are tens of picoseconds long, a very brief hole, but any event that occurs when that hole is not detected. And afterwards, the light is restored to a continuous stream, so the observer need not be aware that there was a cloaking operation going on at all.
Very clever. Before we get to talking about the details of this and how you guys have managed to advance this technique, what would you do with a cloak like this?
The type of implementation we've looked at has components that are compatible with a telecom network. And so one can imagine that perhaps you could hide your information and ensure privacy. So sending bank information, sending national security information are obvious places where people are very interested in privacy. Extending that idea is people sometimes not only want to make their data unable to be read, but to hide the fact that communications is going on at all.
Now, the first instance of a temporal cloak was described in Nature a little over a year ago. What have you done here that's different to that? Could you compare the two methods for me?
The work that was reported by the Cornell group in Nature about a year ago was the first experiment taking the ideas from spatial cloaking and demonstrating that there is a space-time analogy, or we say a space-time duality, and that some of the structures one might envision for doing spatial cloaking could have time domain analogs and implementations. And so they were able to first open up these holes of light to prevent an event being seen and close them back up. To do that required high-power femtosecond laser systems. They're very much a scientific apparatus. They're certainly large and not compatible with most practical applications in communications. Also, because of the powers that are required, the cloak can operate for only very small fractions of time. What we've been able to do is find another approach that could be implemented using common telecom technologies so that the light in time breaks up into a periodic series of holes and could operate at very high rates. And so we operate our rates at 12 gigabits, or let's say 12 billion cloaking events per second are possible, and about half of the time axis can be concealed.
you're probably going to find this question horribly naive, but we're talking mostly about how you might use this to conceal data, bits of data, which I suppose in time they're so short and they're so small that they don't really exist. I mean, could you conceal anything bigger? In principle, could you conceal, like, me?
I would say we need spatial cloaks for that. It does raise the question of what's been referred to as a space-time cloak, whether one could both conceal spatial objects, as in the Harry Potter movies, but also in time. And, you know, in some sense, we look at the Harry Potter movies, the cloak moves with Harry, and so there is some kind of time variation, so that light isn't interacting with the scene at various points in time. Nobody, certainly including us, has done any experiments that explore that yet, but it's a notion that's been raised. For example, the previous Nature paper speculated briefly at the end of their paper on that.
Do you see this technique being used very quickly in the data industry?
Still unclear whether any really killer applications will emerge. I think the key thing is that the immediate ramifications are, for the first time, we've shown that you can take this cloaking phenomena, scientifically very cool but esoteric, and showing that some of these ideas are very compatible with common telecom gear. So in principle, one can make these type of operations. But the larger questions are, does somebody want to conceal their data badly enough that they would add, admittedly, some complication and sort out where does it really work in what's really a big system?
The final question is, in the event that you make a space-time cloak in the near future, if I send you a stamped addressed envelope, would you send me one in the post, please?
Will you pay for the insurance as well?
Absolutely. Will it be really expensive?
We're not ready to cost it out, but I will keep a note of that. Perhaps you'll be our first customer.
Andrew Weiner at Purdue University. And you can find that article hidden in a time hole at nature.com/nature.
This year marks the 100th anniversary of Danish physicist Niels Bohr's atomic model. In his model, published in July 1913, Bohr described how an atom is made up of negatively charged electrons orbiting a positively charged nucleus. The model revolutionised the way we think about atoms and paved the way for quantum mechanics. This week, Nature hosts a special issue exploring its legacy. As one news feature reveals, scientists are testing the limits of Bohr's theory by fiddling with the structure to create all sorts of exotic atoms. That piece is written by Richard van Noorden, and he joins us here in the studio. Richard, tell me, what was Bohr's theory?
Well, Niels Bohr came along at a time when physicists were wondering just what the atom exactly was. And one of the early models was that the electrons were kind of moving through a sort of smeared out positive charge called the plum pudding model, the idea that the electrons were like raisins in a plum pudding. But that was quickly put to rest when a New Zealander, Rutherford, found that in fact the atom has a very, very small core of positive charge, the protons and the neutrons, and the electrons were going around that. And so the idea was it was a bit like a solar system. But then this great question came around. In our solar system, the planets are very slowly spiraling into the sun because of gravitational forces. But in the atom, the electrons should almost immediately go into the center and annihilate, and the atom shouldn't exist. So Bohr came up with this this breakthrough. He said, no, the electrons can only jump from one discrete orbit to another, and when they make transitions, they give out bursts of light. That was the breakthrough, the idea that matter comes in these quantum jumps.
So that system was introduced in 1913, but fast forward 100 years, and scientists are creating all sorts of strange atoms. You've taken a look at a few of them, including antimatter atoms and super-heavy atoms, but first, let's start big with giant atoms.
Yeah, so if you look at an atom from the point of view of the nucleus in the middle, every electron's a long way away, 100,000 nuclear diameters away. But in a giant atom, electrons travel 100 billion nuclear diameters away. A giant atom like that is almost as big as a bacterium. It's as big as the full stop printed at the end of a sentence.
And how do you make them so big?
Well, what you have to do is essentially use lasers to give the electrons jolts of energy that excites them out to large distances. But when they're out that far, they're very fragile. They can easily be removed. So you have to make them in very high vacuum.
What use is an inflated atom?
The point of this atom stretching is that it allows atoms to suddenly become much bigger and have influence over a much greater region of space. So if you have two atoms micrometers apart, they can't normally affect each other. But if you inflate one of them with a laser, suddenly they start to feel each other's influence. So you can imagine using that to make computing systems that are based on atoms, whereby inflating one of them, you suddenly make a connection between the two. In fact, researchers have used this to make logic gates, computing logic gates, that are based on using atoms as a bit of information.
Moving on to another extreme type of atom, antimatter atoms. What are they?
So antimatter atoms are atoms made of antiparticles. And essentially, these are particles that have the same mass as the ordinary particles that we know, protons and electrons, but they have the opposite charge. These are actually made quite commonly when you go for a PET scan. Positrons, anti-electrons, are transiently created. And it just comes out of very, very high energy collisions. And at the Big Bang, which was the highest energy collision of all, we should have seen these antiparticles and these particles created in equal amounts. The problem is, we don't see antimatter around us, we just see matter. So where did all that antimatter go? This is one of the great mysteries about the Big Bang. And the idea of making anti-atoms, which is, say, anti-hydrogen is made of an anti-proton and an anti-electron, is to try and measure how the anti-hydrogen behaves. Does it behave differently than hydrogen? And if it does that explain how we see matter all around us, but we don't see any antimatter?
And last but not least, heavy atoms. Why are physicists creating these super heavy particles?
So the idea with these heavy atoms is, first of all, to try and extend the limits of the periodic table. The periodic table is just a list of all the atoms we know about, listed by the number of protons they have in their nucleus. And by banging two nuclei together and hoping they stick, over the last 70 years, chemists and physicists have made heavier and heavier and heavier atoms. Partly the point of this is just curiosity, because these atoms fall apart within milliseconds as soon as you make them. But there's a mythical region of stability called the Island of Stability, where theory predicts that if you get the right number of protons and the right number of neutrons, your atom should stick around for seconds, maybe minutes or years. It might be a way to make completely new synthetic elements.
Now, all these ideas have come very far from the simple model. What do you think Bohr would make of it if he could be here today?
What I found interesting looking at all of these is that it's really quite hard to get a mental picture of what is actually going on when you talk about hollow atoms or heavy atoms or giant atoms. And yet it's a great mathematical description of what's happening at these very small scales and these very extreme energies. And Bohr, I think, kind of started that whole path of physics away from the classical, here's what you can see in front of you world, into the weird quantum world that is best described by mathematics and is hard to put across in any other way except by metaphor. And he himself said, when it comes to atoms, language can be used only as in poetry. That's the only way you can even begin to make sense of them.
Thanks, Richard. Remember, you can read about all these exotic atoms and more atom-related content at nature.com/Bohr100.
Now it's time for the research highlights, read by Charlotte Stoddart. More exciting atoms, because physicists in Amsterdam have built a quantum microscope and used it to directly observe electron orbitals in hydrogen. Their microscope used lasers to excite the sole electron in a hydrogen atom placed in an electric field. An electrostatic lens then stretched and magnified the orbitals until individual electrons hit a detector. After recording about 50,000 electrons, the researchers created images representing how electrons travel around the nucleus. It's the first time that orbitals could be observed directly, and it's published in Physical Review Letters. Ozone loss in Antarctica makes for wetter summers in parts of South America. To see what might be causing these hikes in rainfall, researchers at Columbia University tested several models of climate change. The models were consistently more accurate when ozone was included than when it was not. As ozone levels in the Antarctic recover, the amount of rainfall should stop increasing and may even decline, the researchers say. That paper is in the journal Climate Dynamics. News chat coming up shortly, but first, a cold, hard look at ice. An ice sheet larger than France, Germany and Britain combined sits atop Greenland, while two even more gargantuan sheets of ice cover Antarctica. Together, they account for more than 99% of the world's freshwater ice, and due to global warming, these giant ice cubes are melting. Just how fast is only becoming clear in recent years, thanks to new satellite measurements and computer models. Edward Hannah, a climate scientist at the University of Sheffield in the UK, summarises the state of ice sheets in this week's Nature. He tells reporter Ewan Calloway why these frozen masses are the proverbial canary in the coal mine for climate change.
To begin with, remind our listeners where these ice sheets are located and just how big they are.
We've basically got three ice sheets, and there's two in Antarctica and one in Greenland. And the Greenland ice sheet is just under 2 million square kilometres, which is the size of several larger European countries combined. But the Antarctic ice sheet is much larger than that.
Why are ice sheets so important to the Earth's climate?
Well, essentially because they're a very good signal of climate change. So basically the mass that's locked up in the ice sheets is very responsive to changes in temperature and the snow that's falling out on top of the ice sheets. So the ice sheets are a bit like a barometer of how the climate's changing. And although until recently it was believed that ice sheets weren't particularly responsive to changes in climate, it was more the sea ice, the frozen parts of the ocean, rather than the land ice that were responding. It's recently been found that there can be some major changes at the edges of the ice sheets, which can be linked to changes further inland.
Now, you mentioned in your Nature review that the last really major survey of ice sheets was the 2007 report by the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, the IPCC. What was the picture that emerged?
Well, the last IPCC report didn't really take into account all the changes that are happening with the movement of the ice, particularly with the around the edges of the ice sheets, because the computer model simulations of the ice sheets that we used to predict their responses to climate change were really completely inadequate at that time. Since that IPCC report, there have been major advances in both observations and models, and it's those which we report here. We've somewhat narrowed the uncertainties in our estimates of the amount of changes in mass in both the Antarctic ice sheet and the Greenland ice sheet since the last IPCC report, and even in last year.
What kind of picture of Greenland's and Antarctica's ice sheets are you coming to?
Basically, we're confirming previous estimates of large mass losses from Greenland over the last decade or so. So it's something like 250 billion tonnes per year. However, for the Antarctic ice sheet, of course, that's two ice sheets together, the East and West Antarctic ice sheet, the amount of mass that has been lost is something of the order of between 40 and 120 billion tonnes per year. Now, that's considerably lower loss of mass than has been reported from some studies in the last two or three years.
Now, is there any chance that any of these ice sheets will collapse, disintegrate?
There is potentially some danger with the West Antarctic ice sheets that there can be further disintegration of ice shelves as that area warms into the future. But while we're reporting on improvements in those models, they haven't necessarily yet been fully implemented to actually predict the behaviour, for example, of the West Antarctic ice sheet. So there's a lot of work still to be done.
How will these estimates influence sea level rise?
So in our paper, we actually have a table showing the sort of consensus estimate of sea level rise from all the various contributors over the last 10 years or so. The ice sheets are just one contribution to global sea level rise, but we also look at the smaller land ice masses, the glaciers and ice caps. And what we found is that in the last decade, the contribution to sea level rise from both ice sheets together, Antarctica and Greenland, is approximately equal to that from the smaller land ice masses, the glaciers and ice caps. Whereas if you look for the last 20 years, the ice sheet contribution was much less.
So that means we need to be paying a lot closer attention to ice sheets.
Yes. So certainly it's really important that various new satellite missions that are planned, there's going to be some critical launches of those in the next 3 or 4 years, go ahead, because we do need to obtain continuous data of the ice sheet changes from these these satellites in order to be able to estimate the current and future contributions of the ice sheets to global sea level rise.
That was Edward Hanna talking to Ewan Calloway. News time now, and I'm joined by Chief News Editor at Nature, Rosie Mestel. Rosie, you've been here for a few months, but this is your debut podcast appearance. Welcome.
Thank you, Carrie. It's exciting.
Now, the first story in the news section this week has to do with plastic wood, which seems a contradiction in terms. What is this stuff?
Well, plastic wood is a sort of fake wood. It's sort of plastic. It may have some kind of processed wood in the core of it or some concrete. And many people, governments, municipalities are turning to it instead of tropical hardwood because they think it's more sustainable, better for the environment. You don't chop down forests and the plastic wood is supposed to last longer.
Now, this is thrown into relief in the story that reporter Jeff Tollefson has written by the fact that New York City are rebuilding Steeplechase Pier out of this stuff.
Yes, yes, they are. I mean, Hurricane Sandy trashed Steeplechase Pier, and it trashed a lot of boardwalks along the east coast of the United States. And so the plan is to not replace it with tropical wood, but to replace it with this plastic wood instead. And it sounds like an ecologically sound decision, but as Jeff's article describes, it may not be so, in fact.
Yeah, so why is that? Because naively, it does seem like it would be a good idea to replace perhaps unsustainable tropical timber with something that can be made cheaply and is just as durable.
Well, there are several reasons why. One is that wood, as it grows, sucks up carbon dioxide from the atmosphere, and that's a good thing because that means you don't accrue so much carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, and that fights climate change. Another reason is that plastic wood is supposedly a wood that will last longer, so you don't have to replace it as often. But in fact, there are scant data on how long the plastic wood actually lasts. And then the other thing is that during the manufacture of plastic wood, you are actually emitting more greenhouse gases than you do when you're harvesting lumber.
So would it be better after all then to go back to using tropical timber as long as it could be sustainably sourced?
Well, I mean, many experts think that that might be the way to go. The problem is, number one, that a lot of the wood is not sustainably sourced. There's a lot of illegal logging. Number two, even legal logging leads to the creation of roads, which then can serve as arteries for all kinds of other illegal development. But governments are trying to work on encouraging sustainable wood production via a variety of measures. So experts think that if you go about using tropical wood in the right way, you're actually encouraging developing worlds to shore up an industry that is better for the environment in the long term.
All right, let's move on to the second story, and from giant trees used for timber to their very, very small relatives. Here we're talking about the Glowing Plant Project, and this has to do with a website called Kickstarter.
Yeah, Kickstarter is this website where you can basically fundraise for your campaigns. And in this article that's written by Ewan Calloway, he notes that this week Kickstarter has, among many of its other offerings, some ultra-premium jerky made of Kobe beef, a keyboard instrument called a wheel harp, and a small leafy plant made with synthetic biology techniques that glows in the dark. Now, this plant has not been made yet. The Kickstarter campaign aims on making it and then selling the seeds to people so they can plant them wherever they want.
So it's a popular project, glowing plants for your front yard. And as of this recording, nearly 8,000 supporters have donated over $440,000. Why have they done this? Why is this interesting to people?
I think they just think it's neat. I mean, the idea is that you take genes from the firefly and you engineer them into this diminutive little weed called Arabidopsis. And if you do this, it will glow a sort of pale greeny yellow color.
Now, if we've got synthetic biologists listening to this, are they going to be impressed by this technology? I mean, it doesn't sound particularly new.
It's not the first time that this has been done exactly. Back in the 80s, scientists produced Arabidopsis plants that glowed in the dark, but they had to have this luciferin chemical sprayed on them. And then the gene that was inserted into the plant, which created an enzyme called luciferase, that luciferase would then work on the luciferin and turn it into a glow. But what these three guys, these three San Francisco entrepreneurs want to do is engineer this whole pathway into Arabidopsis so that you don't need to apply this luciferin anymore. It just glows on its own. And that, too, has sort of been done in bacteria, and they're now proposing to tinker with the genes that they work in the plant as well. I don't think that synthetic biologists would necessarily think this was a huge deal. In fact, one of the entrepreneurs, Anthony Evans, says himself, there are some people in synthetic biology circles who would yawn at what we're doing.
So they have got a bit of a challenge ahead. Now, you said earlier that some of the supporters are likely to get seeds from these plants that they can just plant wherever they like. Now, in the US, obviously, GM and synthetic biology are less hot-button topics than they are here in Europe. But how are people reacting to this potentially widespread planting of these glowing things?
Well, these plants have not been made yet. There are at least, 7,000 or whatever you said, people who are very excited about it. There are experts who express concern not only over, it's not like they're concerned that this particular plant, should it get out and so as you wander down the street, you'd see little glowing weeds everywhere you looked. It's just they think this sets a bad precedent for a field which actually has serious concerns that it wants to tackle. And also it could be really bad PR for the field.
Okay, Rosie Mestel, thank you very much for coming in. That's it for this week. Join us next time when we'll find out how fast cheetahs actually run. I'm Kerry Smith.
And I'm Thea Cunningham.